Hey everyone, this is Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week's episode is supported by We Are One Composites. This fast-growing business is making amazing quality carbon wheels and bars in Kamloops in Canada. I've been on them for a couple of years and most recently I'm riding their Faction rims on my new bike. The finish is incredible, so they look great, and even better, they ride amazing too. Sticking to lines like nothing else, but not pinging off things and pushing you around like some stiffer carbon wheels can do. If that sounds good to you, you can check out their entire range over at wearonecomposites.com. And as a Downtime listener, they are kindly offering you 15% off all stock wheels and their depackaged bar and stem for the month of June. Just use the code HANDLAID2020 at the checkout. That's HANDLAID2020, all lowercase, one word. If you want to help support the podcast and look great at the same time, then head over to my web store now and check out the new range of t-shirts. I didn't think I could do better than the previous t-shirts, but somehow I've managed to find something that's still 100% organic. It's made of even softer cotton, has a really great fit, and it's made using renewable energy too. I've even managed to reduce the pricing. So if you want to represent and help the podcast at the same time, then you can head to downtimepodcast.com/shop now and check them out. Thanks to everybody who's bought one so far. If you're not yet subscribed to the podcast, then get on it and make sure you never miss an episode. It's free, it's super simple to do. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and click the button for whichever platform is best for you. While you're there, you can also subscribe to my newsletter where I'll bring you exciting stuff from the world of mountain biking on a Friday. All right, this week on the podcast, I'm joined by Jack Moore. Jack has had some super tough times, but he's also shown that he's more than capable of mixing it up at the very top of the sport. We chat about his career so far, including multiple collarbone breaks, developing the 29er with Intense that he went on to take to second place at Fort William World Cup, the challenges of changing from the Intense team to, well, the new Intense team, and his recent move to Enduro World Series, where he'll be riding for Canyon Factory Racing. There's also some surf chat thrown in for good measure. So, without further ado, here's Jack Moore. Jack Moore, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Hey, mate. All good, eh? That hasn't changed much. Still been just riding and hanging out, really. Yeah, I guess the only thing different about this time of the year is I'm at home and not overseas. But, yeah, everything else pretty much the same for me.
Yeah, and heading into winter, I guess that's maybe a bit unusual for you guys.
Yeah, it's a little bit chilly, but it's pretty cool to be home this time of year because we get real good waves, and I'm always overseas racing, so that's one good thing about it, being getting a lot of surfing in.
Excellent. Yeah, I was going to ask, so tell us a little bit about your childhood and like where you grew up and what you're into, because I think surfing was a massive passion for you then, yeah?
Yeah. Pretty much started off with like motorbikes, and then just as I got into mountain bikes, I moved up to the coast and started doing a lot of surfing, and kind of, yeah, just went between mountain biking and surfing all through my teenage years. So mountain biking ended up winning the overall battle.
Winning the battle, yeah. But you're a competent surfer. Did you compete when you were younger in surfing or not really?
Oh, I just did like some, yeah, little comps around East Coast of Oz growing up. Nothing serious. I'm not that good.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's hard. It's not a sport I know well, but like I've seen a few little clips of you doing it, and it looks like you're very good at it. But I'm not that familiar with the sport, so
yeah, I'll let you be. I suppose it. Like I'm all right, but like. It's just like riding, I suppose. Like the top guys are just insane. It's just, I suppose it's hard to tell when you don't do it, because it's one of those sports, like if you're just looking in from the outside, you just see someone going across a wave and you're like, oh yeah, they're good. But like, it's just crazy how good people have gotten at it.
Yeah, fair play. And do you think there's a good crossover, a good kind of relationship between surfing and mountain biking? Are there similarities? Do the two help each other?
I don't know. Like, I guess there's no way to prove it, but maybe timing and flow and stuff like that. But also, if it's real fun, like, or real good waves. Are you out there for like three, four hours at a time, just nonstop paddling and catching waves. So I guess it's pretty good fitness and like upper body sort of strength and endurance.
Yeah, pretty physical stuff. And you, I guess we can't really talk to you without mentioning your shark attack, which you've become a little bit famous for in the mountain bike world, I guess. You were quite young at the time, weren't you?
Yeah, I was 13. It was in 2007.
Yeah. What happened?
Yeah, I was just basically out surfing, caught a wave in. I was standing up in waist deep water, so it wasn't like I was far out. And I felt something grab my leg, but where we were surfing, no one really surfed. It was like just this little rock bay, but it filled up with sand, so it had some good banks, which made the waves pretty good in there. And like when you walked out, since no one ever went there, you always stepped on stingrays, and they like, yeah, they were like sometimes like flutter up and like wrap around your leg a bit or something. So when I got bitten, I thought it was like a stingray or something, because the teeth are so sharp, you just don't feel it. And then I like like just thrashed my leg out of its mouth, and then it kind of re-grabbed like my foot and my heel. And then, but at the same time, the water was like sucking out, and it was getting shallower and shallower, and it got to about knee height, and it just sort of let go and was just thrashing on the sand to get back out. So I just caught a wave in.
Pretty scary.
Yeah, it was for sure.
Yeah. And you had an offer from your dad, I think, to pay, was it $1 per stitch?
Yeah. Who told you that?
I can't remember where I heard this one. I thought it was pretty cool because you ended up with quite a lot of stitches. You've done all right out of it, yeah?
Yeah, for a gram, I got like $110. I think that was, he only did the outside stitches though. I had like 400 or 500 on the inside. If he paid me $1 for them, I would have been balling. But he just paid me, $1 for all the ones on the outside, which was 110.
Still, that's pretty good at a young age, right?
Yeah, I still had a bit of cash to play with.
Nice. Did you spend it on anything good, or did it get spent down the sweet shop?
I can't even remember. Probably put it into some bike parts. I would have got some nice anodized red pedals or something.
Yes.
Let me Kona Stinky. Cool.
Yeah, that's an awesome. That's quite often a lot of people seem to go to that as their first, like, do everything bike. It's a popular ride.
Yeah, I guess it was just a sort of a cheap, capable bike. Yeah, heaps of buddies I know had those bikes.
Before we move on from surfing, I've spotted that you've been doing a bit of foil boarding recently, which is something that I've seen a little bit of, but it looks absolutely insane. Tell us a little bit about what it is and like how it feels.
Oh yeah, that's real fun. I got into it because a couple of my buddies started doing it. So when I got my appendix out, I shaped like a foil board with my mate Harry and Rob. And then I just bought a secondhand foil off Marketplace on Facebook and whacked that on, because if you get it all new, it's like pretty expensive to get into. So I got that, and then I just started going out with them because they've been doing it for maybe a year now, and they kind of showed me how to do it, like got me up to speed with it a bit quicker than normal, because it's actually real hard. It's like learning to surf again, but totally different. It's weird. You're just like hovering above the water, and it's something you can do when the waves aren't very good. So it's like, it's just a cool sort of board to have. Yeah, if there's not good waves, you just you can take the ski out and just tow into like swell lines. Like, it doesn't even have to be breaking. You just need like the tiniest sort of swell line or ripple in the water, and the foil just generates speed off it, I guess. And yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Does it feel quite similar to surfing or very different? Because the board that you're on is kind of what, like a foot out of the water, basically.
Nah, yeah, it's just totally different. Like, with where you've got to have all your weight and just how to turn it and everything's like, it's just totally different to surfing. Like, it's actually real hard. I would, I kind of, like I said before, got all right at it quicker because my mates have been spending a lot of time doing it and they were just telling me how to do it without like a bit of sort of coaching from them. I wouldn't know what to do. Like you gotta, it's crazy. Like if you pick up a little bit too much speed, like the bigger the roll of swell, like the faster you start to go. And if you, as soon as you pick up speed, the foil wants to come out of the water. So you got to lean forward a heap. And if you don't lean forward enough in the foil, as soon as that foil comes out of the water, you just get, you get sent over the bars. It had some pretty big rags, eh? Like you just think, oh, you hit water. But when you're going fast, you get ragdolled.
And is it similar speed-wise to surfing or is it quicker? Or
You go a lot faster. Oh, I guess it depends what wave you're surfing. If you're surfing good waves, you'd go fast. But for what I surf, you go a lot faster on the foil.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah. Be good to watch that.
Yeah, another activity to do in the water. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, yeah, let's talk a bit about the mountain biking side of things then. So you said it, you were riding like from a young age. How did you get into it?
Yeah, I started riding motos early on. His dad was big into motorbikes and yeah, he had us all on motorbikes pretty young. But then my older brother and his buddy started riding mountain bikes, just building these big senders and North Shore and stuff up at our house because we lived up in the bush. And I thought that looked pretty mad. So I had a go on his old hardtail like a couple times and I was frothing and I just wanted to do what they were doing. So yeah, dad got me that Stinky for Christmas. Would have been 2006 when I was 12, I think 12 or 13.
And what were your local trails like? Was there a lot of riding around where you are?
So my first ride, I rode around where I live now, which has a heap of trails, and then literally moved up the coast maybe 2 weeks after that. And then there was like no riding. So I got into riding just as I moved from the bush up to the coast. So it was a bit harder, but there was still a real fun track a couple hours north at Coffs Harbour, which is still a real good track today. So that's where I did most of my riding.
And am I right in thinking a friend of yours, Tim, was a big part of riding in your life?
Yeah, Tim, he's actually Pat Butler's dad. He's raced World Cups the last couple of years. But yeah, Timbo, I met him when I moved back down the coast. I was in like year 9 at school and I started doing some coaching with him at school because he always coached the kids at school and the PE teacher said he was after someone to help him. So that's how I met Tim and then I started working for him to save up to do my first season overseas. He's a stainless plumber. And he's also got a background in bikes and training and stuff. So he kind of used to train with me and would go riding before and after work. And he would give me whatever time off I needed to go racing overseas and stuff. So it was real cool. Would have been pretty hard to do it all without him.
Yeah, fair play. So you were a plumber's apprentice then, like Petey?
I wasn't an apprentice. I was just like labor, I guess. Like I never did an apprenticeship. I was just working to, get money.
Do you remember your first race then?
Yeah, it was at Coffs Harbour, that track I was just talking about. I think it was a state round. Yeah, Coffs Harbour state round under 15s, I think it was, and I got third.
Okay, yeah, you got to be pretty happy with that first race.
Yeah, it was fun.
And so did you think at that point, like, well, maybe I could be pretty good at this, or was it just something you enjoyed and got excited about?
Yeah, I just really enjoyed it. I got super hooked on it and just, yeah, I just remember all I wanted to do was just try to get faster, to try just go better and win those little races, even though they didn't mean anything. But yeah, got real hooked. It was something fresh. So
how did you get then from like third place at some little races to the point where you were considering traveling abroad and going to a World Cup?
Yeah, just did those New South Wales state rounds. They used to be awesome. They don't quite have them anymore. They're more like club rounds. But yeah, they used to have the New South Wales state series, which was sweet. And then did some national rounds. And yeah, it just kind of, I got selected for the junior worlds team my second year 19s. First year 19s, I wasn't quite good enough because there was a heap of good guys in our year. We had Troy, Connor, Dino's in my year, the second one. And then there was a bunch of other really fast guys like Dave McMillan, Tommy Crimmins. So yeah, first year I didn't even make it on the worlds team. Second year, I was probably like one of the last couple picks. So once I made it on there, I was like, did Leo Gang in a couple World Cups. And then that was when I was like, oh, I might have a gap year next year and try do some more racing. So I was never like set on, oh, this is what I'll do. It kind of just I just kind of kept getting a little bit better and a few opportunities opened up and I took them.
Yeah. Yeah. So first World Cup was 2012, Mont St. Anne?
Yeah. Yeah. 2012, Mont St. Anne on the 15-inch orange. I think it was a small orange 224 with flat pedals. Yeah. Just bombing down Mont St. Anne. I don't know how. I remember blowing my feet like once a run at least. I don't know how I survived, but yeah, that was it. I remember I was super nervous to qualify. I just qualified and then ended up getting, I think it was 44th in the race. So I was real pumped on that.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive on a tiny bike for your first ever. Was that your first time racing abroad or not?
Yeah, that was the first time overseas.
Yeah, and Mont St. Anne's not really the track where you want a tiny, short bike either, is it?
Man, just even I go there now and I just can't prepare for that track because it's just so fast and rough and your hands get beat, everything gets beaten. There's no way to get ready for it because we just don't have any tracks that speed or that type of roughness back home. So no matter what you do, you still show up and just I feel like I still can't hang on. But so yeah, I don't know how I did it on a 26-inch small orange with flat pedals.
How did you end up on a small bike? I mean, I guess everyone rode smaller bikes back then, but I'm guessing
I wasn't actually, I think I had a growth spurt like maybe around that time.
Okay.
So yeah, I probably wasn't that tall, but everyone rode small bikes. Now it's more of a thing to ride longer bikes, but I think back then I always, used to ride small bikes.
You managed to get yourself a slot on the Bergamot team, like around that sort of, was it 2013, 2014 kind of time frame?
Yeah, that was 2014. So after 2012, me, Dave, Luke Ellison and Joey Vavoda, we went over to Europe and I think the full World Cup series, but we just got a van and traveled. So that was pretty sick. So I was like a year of privateering. I was kind of like helped out by the Yeti guys too, which was cool. So yeah, I did that for a year and I got maybe a couple top 30s or something towards the end. That was when I had to stop riding flat pedals. I went to Val d'Isol and literally every run I was blowing my feet and then I just qualified and then in racing, came into the first shoot, blew my feet off and just got this, because I had massive pins in my flat pedals, got this massive gouge out of the back of my calf and I fell off and I got to the bottom and I was so salty. So I was like, fuck it, I'm learning to ride clips, and literally just went to Morzine straight after that. And it was just, I remember it was just pounding rain for weeks and I just learned to ride clips in the wet, muddy roots of Morzine. It seriously like took 2 weeks and I was like, why didn't I just do this earlier?
What do you think the benefits are then? Because obviously you've got that steep learning curve to go through and Morzine in the wet's probably not the easiest place to do it. But once you sussed it, what was different?
Just being able to keep your feet on, man. I don't know how Connor and that do it. It's like, yeah, just how fast and rough the tracks are. It's literally, you just don't worry about it. You just don't have to worry about your feet blowing off. But I guess, like, yeah, before that, I'd just never ridden clips in my life. So I was like always set on flat pedals, and I still love riding them when I come home. Super fun. But yeah, for racing, I had the swap.
Yeah, fair play. So then, yeah, 2014, you moved onto a deal with Bergamot.
Yeah.
Is that your first sort of the first time you'd consider yourself like riding for a proper team?
It was a lot better. I think I just had to pay for a couple flights, and we still gypsied it a bit. I'd say my first year riding for a pro team would be intense.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it was still like, it was definitely a lot more help and better like at the races than the year before, but still like working on our own bikes, gypsying it, and like, yeah. But we had full support from Bergamot and all the sponsors, so we didn't have to worry about breaking parts and stuff like that, which was cool. But yeah, that was, yeah. That's got to be one of the best years I've had. It was so much fun. Yeah.
Eddie Masters and Casey Brown as teammates.
Yeah. Eddie, Casey, and Maylink was like mechanic, party guy, and bus driver.
And I'm guessing there was a fair bit of partying that season.
A little bit.
Is it hard to balance, like when it's wild and getting a bit out of control, is it hard to balance the racing and the fun side of it, which is, you know, it's still super important?
I didn't really even think of it that much then. I guess we just, like, we weren't being stupid. We'd just maybe celebrate and party after the race, but during the week, maybe if there was a big block in between races at Morzine, we might hit the opera for a bit of D-floor cardio. but like, it's not like we were, yeah, going stupid. Still getting training done and focusing on race weekends.
Yeah. And it paid off, right? That was your first, I guess, big result in 2014 with, was it 10th place at Half Hill?
Yeah, I got 11th at Cairns at the, I think it was the second race. And then had a couple, maybe like in the low 20s throughout the year, and then a top 10 at the Worlds. So that was a good year.
Is that kind of where the discussions with Intent started? Was it that result that helped you get in the door there, or were you already in discussion?
Yeah, no, it was like literally just after Worlds. I was going to re-sign with the Bergamot guys because it was such a good thing we had going, and I had so much fun. And then the Intense guys got onto me. I think it was Ivan. Ivan was running the team at the time, who was then my mechanic for a few years. But yeah, he got onto me and said that it was going to be the first year that it was going to a factory team with Intense. So I was like, yeah, that'd be sweet. Then I think Bergamot matched the offer, and I was like, I just seriously didn't know what to do because I really wanted to race for Intense, but I didn't know how it would be, and I just knew how fun it was being on Bergamot with Eddie and Casey and Maylink and that. So I was like really kind of tossing up what to do that off season, but then it was just, I just thought Intense would be better for my career in the long run, so I decided to go with those guys.
Yeah, it's a bit of a dream team for a lot of people who ride mountain bikes. I would say the chance to ride on Intense is going to be hard to turn down.
Yeah, just crazy bikes, and they, like, it was always all the heaps of the top dogs when I was growing up raced in tents, like especially the Aussies. Like I think Sam was on them, Carver was on them. So it was like, yeah, it was sort of like a dream. So in the end, it was a hard decision, but it was an easy decision.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're going on to this, I guess, first sort of, like you say, factory ride with Intense. Must be super exciting. Big off season, getting prepared, coming off the back of a pretty good 2014. And then you're out riding somewhere near Barcelona, I think, wasn't it? Pre-season for 2015.
Yeah, 2015.
Yeah. And then the dream turned into a little bit of a nightmare for a while. Can you talk us through kind of what went on?
Yeah, that was a horrible year, eh? I mean, 2014, I actually dislocated my shoulder in Les Deux Alpes for the crankworks. And it kind of went straight back in. So I got physio on it and raced the rest of the season, no dramas at all. And then that off season, when I got home, I was skating with the fellas up the skate park, and I just kind of looped out and put my arm out, and it just popped out straight away. And I was like, fuck. So I went and got that surgery on that, which is a good, you'd say 4 to 6 months for it to be perfect. So I had just finished rehabbing all that, race national champs for Intense, was back up to speed and everything. That was my first ever injury as well.
Okay.
Like throughout, up to that part of my career, I'd never really hurt myself. So I was like, sweet, good to go. Went over to Spain, just doing some, I was going to be in Spain for like 3 or 4 weeks before Lourdes was the first round, I think.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, literally like a few days after I got there, I went downhill riding and I followed this guy into a jump at the bottom, and I didn't know it because I was riding the track blind, and I was just like, oh, I'll just follow him and do everything he does. And last minute he jammed the brakes on because it was a bit windy down the bottom, and he kind of doubled this triple thing, and I just went off it with the speed I had and like cased the triple, got blown by the wind a bit, so landed sideways and then just got thrown off, broke my collarbone. And that was like no biggie, just a broken collarbone. I might miss the first couple races. But then that just turned into a nightmare. Yeah, it ended up turning into a bone infection and stuff, and I literally didn't race a World Cup for a year and a half. Maybe
saying that, yeah. So the first, so that from that Barcelona crash, that got plated, didn't it? And then,
yeah. So, it got plated, and then it wouldn't heal over. So they cleaned it out and restitched it, and then it still wouldn't heal, but because the infection. Since they didn't take the plate out the first time, the infection had gone. It can live in like the threads of the plate. This is what my surgeons told me back home. The infection can live in the threads of the bolts that go into the plate. So it had the infection. They took me back in, cleaned me up, restitched it, but didn't take the plate out. Infection was still there. They gave me antibiotics. It got rid of the infection in the skin or the wound or whatever, but since it had gone into the threads of the plate, the white blood cells, the antibiotics can't get to it to kill it there because there's no blood flow into there. So as soon as you get off the antibiotics, the infection comes back out of the bolt. So I'm like, sweet, been on antibiotics for like 4 months or something. I don't know what it was. Riding in Morzine, riding in Leogang, didn't do the World Cup, riding in Morzine, all good. And then went to Lenzerheide for the World Cup there. Had this little crash. I came into a section and my foot unclipped and I went off a drop with like one of my feet out, which meant my other foot crank was down, and I clipped it and I just like went over the bars like but it wasn't bad at all, like just a real tiny one, and it just snapped my collarbone in half, and I was like pretty devoed, but went home. And then the surgeon back home, who I'd been talking to the whole time, was kind of like, I told you this would happen, because I was filling him in on what would happen, what was going on over there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he took the old plate out. No. Oh, I can't even remember now. Maybe the old plate. I think he had to take the old plate out and put a new one in. But I had this crazy, like, tube going into my heart for, like, I think it was, like, two months where it was just, like, straight antibiotics, because the antibiotics you take in tablets or whatever, like, weren't strong enough. So it was pretty serious to try to get rid of the bone infection. And then
so you're literally carrying around some kind of little bottle of antibiotics.
I had like a bottle. I wasn't really, I was pretty much just chilling at home. But yeah, if I wanted to go somewhere, I had this fucking bottle hanging out of me.
Whoa.
But yeah, so did that. Then I was on like 3 months of antibiotics for... Yeah, for 3 months, then, so that was that year done. I thought everything was good, went training again, got back up to speed, coming into 2016, did all the nationals. I think I won the overall for the nationals and stuff, so I was like, sweet, I'm riding good. Went over to team camp in 2016. It was like maybe 2 weeks in there shooting with Crank Brothers, and I clipped a rock just like at the end of, it was end of the day, late of, just stupid, clipped a rock with my pedal, went over the bars, landed on my shoulder, snapped my collarbone. So came back home. Turns out there was, it was still a bit of infection in there. So same thing. Had to take the plate out, put a new one in.
Jeez.
And then, yeah, it was like same sort of setup for that. And then I missed Lords that year. And then my first race was Cairns. Yeah. So that would have been like, yeah, nearly, it would have been a year and a half or more since my last World Cup in, my World Champs in Half Shell in 2014.
Yeah. Is that enough to make you want to stop doing the sport?
Yeah, there was some pretty shitty moments throughout all that, eh, where I just didn't think it was worth it at all. Like, just, yeah, I love riding and racing, but I love doing lots of other things like surfing and all that. So like, there was a few moments through there where I was like, fuck, is it worth it? Like, it just kind of affecting my whole life, really. Like, just keep getting hurt, and like, it didn't feel like I wasn't trying to be a gnarly, like I wasn't doing anything crazy. It just kind of kept happening because the bone infection was hanging around, and it just felt like I couldn't get rid of it. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, we ended up getting on top of it, and I was just super lucky and grateful that Intense kind of looked after me that whole first part of my pro career where I didn't even do a race.
Yeah, but yeah, brutal start.
That first World Cup in Cairns was where it all turned around. It was a shitty result. I got like 40th or something, but I was just like, yes, I've finished a race and I'm back on track, because for so long I was just like training, working my ass off, getting back to race speed, and then crashing, and then it would all happen again, and it just felt like this never ending cycle. And like every time I started back up again, or I started getting into serious training again, I'm like normally when you're training, you're like, all right, sweet, this is all going to pay off, like it'll be worth it. But I just started to lose sight of like, how is this worth it when I just keep ending up in hospital? I'm not even racing, I'm not even using my training. Like, it was just hard to put 100% into riding and training when I just thought, okay, I'm just gonna get hurt again and not be able to race anyway. So it was just like, just felt like a never ending cycle. So when I did the race in Cairns and finished and everything was all good, I was like, sweet. And then, yeah, that year just got better. I think I got a top 30 at Fort Williams, still nothing special. Got a top, I think I got 32nd at Weogang, still obviously not where I wanted to be. And then I had a good race at the Crankworks in Leger, and then I felt real good. I went into Lenzerheide and I got 20th, and I was like under a second off like 12 off Dino in, I think he got 12, and I was like getting her down around the top 10 was just like my goal. Like I was just like, I need to get back to where I was in Norway that at the end of 2014.
Yeah.
So I was close there and I was getting like sort of real hungry and like I knew I could do it. So I was just training hard, doing a lot of riding over there, and then went to Mont-Saint-Anne and I never go good in time training, and I got like 10th in time training there or something. I was like, sweet, I'm riding good. And then I got a flat at Mont-Saint-Anne and I was like, no, in qualifying. So then I was going to go home after Mont-Saint-Anne, and I ended up saying to Bernie, who was the manager at the time, can I go Whistler? And because I just wanted to do more racing and just felt like I was riding good. So I went to Whistler and I got third at the Gibanzo and second at Crankworks, and everything just felt like it was kind of clicking. And then I got two top tens at the last World Cup in Andorra and World Champs. So that was just like such a relief to finish that year and like sort of be back to where I knew I could just 2 years later. But it just felt like real good to finally beat that injury, even though it seemed to just linger and hang around forever.
Yeah, man, that must have felt pretty amazing. And then obviously into 2017 season, and that was when I think you guys started working on the 29er, yeah?
Yeah, so that off season, I normally have a fair bit of time off in the off season, but it was like, I think I went a month and I was just like, just wanted to keep riding, and I just knew, I just felt like I could go better than I was. So I was real keen and eager to keep at it. I started riding real early that off season, and then we went to team camp again. I think it was January, and Jeff had the 29er prototype like ready for us to test, and we only got to do like a day on it right at the end of team camp before we went home, because we were waiting on some wheels. It was real hard to get wheels and forks and stuff back then.
Yeah.
So we got like a day on it, and it was at Fontana, which is just a wooden tested downer bike there, but it was like our only spot. Everywhere was snowed in or something, or it's the only place we could get to in time. But we did a couple laps on that, and I thought it was sick. It just felt good for me, the new design and the bigger wheels and bigger bike. It just felt real good to me. So we were like, oh, when can we ride this? And they were not keen on us racing it all year.
Right.
But,
okay.
Jeff was real keen for us to race it, because he just loves that stuff. He loves like race testing, and he's just super passionate about building crazy bikes. And like, obviously the only way you can test properly is at race speeds and like at World Cups and stuff. So somehow he got around the, well, I guess he was running the company, so he probably told him what was up, but managed to convince the marketing guys that we need to do this. So they got me a 29er. It was It was right before Fort William, but that year had already started off good because I got home from team camp, went to a nationals in Oz, and ended up winning that. And then I went to Crankworx Rotorua, ended up winning that. And then I also did the EWS there and got sixth. So I was like, frothing on that. And then come home. Oh, no, we went to Lords after that. I didn't go too well. I felt like I was riding good, but I got it better than most guys in the, like at the end there, but I got like a bit of the rain and wind. So I think I got 14th or something there, but I knew I was riding good. Came home and then I won the national champs. So I was like frothing on that. And then that's when I got the bike like a week before Fort William. Did a couple laps on it, like, or a couple days on it at my local track, Owabba, which is pretty good, decent track. Like, maybe 3.5 minutes, and it's rough and pretty fast for, like, an Oz track. It's probably one of the closest tracks we have in Oz to a World Cup, maybe.
Okay.
So it was kind of good testing. Like, I kind of, like, knew this is going to be a fast bike at a World Cup track. And then, yeah, went to Fort William with like a couple days on it and it just felt awesome. And that's when I got that sick result in Fort William. So that year was just, yeah, it just started off real good. I guess I just built off a solid, consistent year in 2016 and I had no injuries or anything to worry about. And I just, yeah, just everything kind of clicked and the new bike worked for me, so.
Yeah, and that crew seemed to work well. Like you, Dean, and Charlie just seemed to gel, and like you were always riding in trains in practice, and there seemed to be like a really good vibe between you three.
Yeah, that year was insane. We also had Nicky, the junior Nick Nesteroff, and it was just, yeah, we all got on so well. It was super fun, eh? It was almost like just traveling the world with your buddies. Like we're real good buddies, so. It was real cool.
Yeah, and developing super fast bikes while you're doing it, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, that was awesome. Jeff used to come to a heap of the races and see what was happening. And yeah.
Is it true that the aluminium frames they spotted at Andorra that they'd cracked just before qualifying, so they decided not to tell you guys so that you'd still go and send it, and then they got them welded up that night ready for the race?
Yeah. Chaffee found it, but he knew it wasn't like, I think he knew it wasn't gonna be like bad if something did happen. It was in like the rear or the, it would have like if something happened bad, like would have just, the back end would have just sunk down and you would have just like dragged to a stop. It wasn't like the head tube or something gnarly.
Yeah.
But then yeah, we just raced Collies and he's like, get your bikes back to the pits ASAP. And then they had to go and find a welder to weld them up for finals.
Amazing. I think the welder was an intense fan though, wasn't he?
Yeah, well Bernie knew him. Luckily Bernie's from like just Barcelona area, so a couple hours down the road, and he knows a lot of people around there. Otherwise we might have been struggling.
Yeah. Amazing. And then I think you ended up 2018 with another broken collarbone, yeah?
Yeah. That was, yeah, so the rest of 2017 went sick. I think I had the number 3 plate for a bit, and then I had the number 5 plate all the way until the end in Val d'Isol, and I just lost it. I think I got 7th. I got 7th overall, but then went to Cairns and got 4th at the world. So it was just like a crazy way to end the year with all my friends and family out there and good result. So I was just so pumped with that. And then coming into 2018, I had like this little niggling back injury in the off season that wouldn't go away, but it wasn't like bad, it was just muscular. And I sat out a heap of racing before the World Cups, but I was still riding good. I did a couple nationals and I went good at them. And then I went to Croatia. Maybe I thought I was a little underprepared because of that, but I'm never really good on short tracks. And I got sixth at Croatia. So I was like pretty stoked on that. And I thought it was going to be a real good year. And then, yeah, I was just doing some training with Dino and I came off and just landed on my shoulder and broke my collarbone again. So I missed a few races. But
was that a more straightforward break though that time? You didn't have any
plates or anything in there, and it was, the infection was gone. So it was just, yeah, didn't even need surgery, just leave it and wait for it to heal properly.
Yeah.
I went over to Val d'Isol and Andorra and I was thinking of racing them, but then I did some riding in Val d'Isol downhill for the first time and I was like, no way I'm racing this. And then went to Andorra and rode practice and I was like, it's just better if I don't race.
Yeah.
Like, considering what's happened in the past, I thought I'll just sit out one race and make sure I'm coming back good. So I just mucked around in practice and did a cruisy qualifying run. And it was just, that was real good to just be back riding at the World Cups again. And then that year wasn't a complete write-off because I came back at Montsenan and I got 11th, which I was really hoping to get top 10, but 11th I was still happy with. And then I got a top 10 at the next race in Le Bresse after that. So I felt like it didn't set me back much at all. And I was pumped on that.
Yeah. And then after that, you were probably the only rider I can think of that's effectively stayed on the same team, but pretty much changed teams, because the Intense team went through a big change when it moved to being kind of the project that I guess Aaron Gwynn was a big part of putting together. You stayed, Dean and Charlie moved on, and then Aaron and Nico came on board. And for them, I guess they brought a lot of their sponsors over from the YT days, which meant you had a huge amount of change, I suppose. Just the frame was pretty much the only carryover, yeah?
Yeah, probably just the frame. Like, all the parts were different and the whole team was different as well, yeah. So, like, literally not a single person from the previous team was on the team, or pretty much a single sponsor. Yeah. So it was a massive, massive change up for me.
Yeah. What was it like trying to learn all of that new product? Cause you've gone from SRAM to Fox and, you know, different brakes, tires, all sorts.
Yeah. It was a lot more of a struggle than I thought it would be. I thought an off season would be plenty of time to learn a bunch of that stuff. And I think it was, but then in the end, yeah, I just never really got on with a couple of the components or parts we had to run with that. And I guess it was just hard because I'd ridden the same spec or the same parts I'd been comfortable with for so long. So it was just hard.
Yeah, made it into a tough season for you, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the results, yeah, they show that.
Yeah, fair play. So at what point then did you start looking around for other options, other deals?
I kind of got real frustrated in the middle of the season when I kept going worse than I thought I could, and nothing was really changing. So I kind of, like, a couple people reached out to me and I just started talking to them. Cause yeah, I was like, it was just hard cause I was so used to, when I signed my contract with Intense, it was with all the parts and components or whatever, like the whole team. It was like what I was comfortable with and what I knew. And I kind of thought like it would be like that the whole time. And then when it changed, I was like, all right, sweet. Like I wasn't angry. Like I knew I could learn a lot from Nico and Aaron and Todd and that, but I was concerned with a few things just because I was so comfortable on my old bike. And I was told if I didn't like some of the components or parts, I could go back to running what I was used to. And then that towards the middle of the season, it wasn't how it was. I had to use the other stuff, and I just wasn't comfortable on some things. And I was clearly slower on them compared to, like, I did some testing with my mechanic back home, and I was just so much consistently faster on my old setup. So I was going to races knowing, I don't know if it was a bad thing that I did that testing, but I wanted to show myself that, like, I wasn't riding that much slower than the year before, you know?
Yeah.
So it just felt like I was going to races already at a disadvantage because I wasn't comfortable with my bike. So that, I got super frustrated and started talking to some people halfway through the year.
Yeah. Was it much of a difference in the times then that you saw during that testing? Like, how significant can some of those elements be?
I was like consistently going around 3 to 5 seconds. Like 3 was the smallest margin and 5 was the largest margin with my old bike.
On that 3.5 minute.
On that local track I have.
Wow. Okay. And that's a big difference these days at a World Cup, right?
Yeah. At a World Cup these days, a second or two is just, it's so much. And if you're not comfortable on your bike, then it's so hard to make up just a second or two, which could be 10 to 15 spots. Like, it's just,
that's
crazy.
Insane. Yeah. Yeah. Fair play. So you'd ended up, you had a letter of intent signed for a spot on a downhill team for what would have been this season. And then that kind of got, the team got cancelled, right?
Yeah.
How late in the day was that?
It was like, so I ended up kind of making a decision at Snowshoe to test a bike for this team. Got it sent home. I really liked it. So I was like, sweet. But then they said they wouldn't have a contract ready for a while. So I don't know why. And I said, well, I don't want to risk waiting for you guys and missing out, because I had a couple opportunities. Yeah. I don't want to wait for you guys and end up missing out. And they said, well, we can do a letter of intent. And I was like, all right, sweet. And I'd heard of a letter of intent before, and I thought, perfect. So after I tested the bike and I really liked it, I signed that. And then it kind of felt like their tone changed a bit after that, and they were kind of dragging it out. And then they gave me a date where they'd tell me, like, if they're sending the contract or not. And then I'd realized that their tone had changed a bit. And I've reached out to a couple of the other teams, and people were saying, like, man, if you've signed a letter of intent, you need to stick by that. And I was like, yeah, I mean, sure, you're probably right. But I kind of wanted to make sure I had something as well. Yeah. So it was a sticky situation. I ended up just listening to listening to them and waiting. And then on the day they gave me a date and I rang them up, they rang me up and they're like, yeah, the team's done. And I was just like, fuck sake. Like I just, for some reason, I just felt like that was going to happen, even though it just felt like so, even though it felt like someone wouldn't do that or it couldn't happen. I had this feeling for like those few weeks I was waiting. Anyway, that's what happened. And then I got onto the teams that I was kind of talking to through the year and they were all sorted, and which is fair enough. Like I wasn't, as soon as I made up my mind, I kind of stopped talking to all those people. So it was my fault. Like, but you can't really, at the same time, I can't really sign the letter of intent and just keep stringing everyone else along just in case it doesn't work. So it was just, it was such a shitty situation. And yeah, I got dicked in the end, but
yeah.
So then I was looking for something, like anything really. I couldn't find much. And then I was like, man, would I go privateer again? And then I was like, yeah. But then I just remembered, like, actually everything you've got to do to be a privateer is actually you just forget about it after being on a factory team. I'm like, do I really want to live, like, to come from Australia, unless you're living out of a van, like, it's just going to cost so much.
Yeah.
And I was like, do I want to live out of a van, eat shitty food, have to work on my bike, worry about not having enough spares, like all this stuff. And I was like, pretty much came to the decision if I didn't get a ride, I was going to have a year off. And then I just reached out to Wynn and asked him if he knew of any enduro teams, like looking for riders. And then he got me under Bass Major from the Da Vinci team, and he sent me a bunch of contacts. So that was handy. But most people had sorted the like enduro teams as well. But then Eddie Masters messaged me and said to message Fab from Kenya. So I just sent him a little message, and then yeah, we ended up working something out where I could do downhill and enduro. So
yeah, it turned out to be a pretty sweet little deal, really.
Yeah, to get on a team that good so late, I got lucky, and yeah, I'm pretty grateful.
Yeah, definitely. So how are you feeling about EWS? That's going to be, well, we're not much of a race season at this point, but that would have been your main focus this year, yeah?
Yeah, I was pretty, like, if you asked me last year if I was doing enduro this year, I'd be like, hell no. But I always wanted to do enduro. I just didn't think it would be so soon, because I've done three EWS races before, and I, like, dude, I had so much fun. It's pretty much just what everyone says. You just get to ride way more. You get to ride sick tracks. Like, they're all natural, just raw, like, sick tracks.
Yeah.
And you just do that for, like, 4 days straight with your buddies. So,
and your results were good as well, right? All top 10.
Yeah, I got eighth at Le Twirl, which is like an Italian one, in 2016. And then I did two in 2017. It was Rotorua, where I got, I think it was sixth. And then
yeah,
I got maybe ninth at, what's it called? Tassie.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was, like, I knew I could go pretty well at them, and I really enjoyed them. So I was like, why not, really? And now that I'm doing it, it's just like so refreshing having a different style of training. And because obviously I'm focusing on the enduro, I'm training for that more so than the downhill. I'm just going to race. Well, I was going to race some World Cups as well, but obviously the schedule's probably going to be a bit too tight now with all this
yeah
shit going on. But it's just like really cool to be doing, having a new focus and doing some different training and stuff. Really enjoying like longer rides and just riding way more. Sweet.
Good stuff. Yeah. And how was team camp? Were you, you came over to Europe for that?
Yeah, it was fun. I went to France, Nice, pretty cool place.
Yeah.
Yeah, did met the team there. Yeah, get along with them real well. It was, I had heaps of fun, eh? Did some testing with SRAM, which was good. I actually felt real comfortable on the bike after team camp, which was just sort of, not a relief, but it just felt good to come home. Yeah. Like it just felt like a successful few weeks over there, eh? Like sometimes I'll do, like over the last couple of years, I'll do suspension testing with like RockShox or Fox I did last year, but you just kind of feel like you're chasing your tail, and at the end of the weekend you're like, did I really get anywhere? Or like, is my bike any faster? Because sometimes it's hard to really know what's the best. Like something, yeah. Obviously, you probably heard it all before, but something that is actually faster might not feel better. So it's really hard. But I just felt good and fast after the testing we did. And I just felt super comfortable on the bike, which is, yeah, it was nice.
Yeah, good stuff. And what was it like working with Fabian? Because he's obviously got a hell of a background and he's a real thinker when it comes to, well, everything, I think, the bike, the setup, the psychology of racing.
Yeah, that's probably why I felt pretty good, because he was helping out a lot too. Gave me a couple little tips and things to change, which have been good so far. I'm just hanging to race and see how I go.
Fair play. What sort of things did he look at for you to change then? Were there anything you can talk about there?
One thing he noticed, which I did know that I did differently to everyone else, is like run my cleats real far up up the front of my shoes.
Uh-huh.
And I did it because you feel like when you're riding on the balls of your feet, you feel more in control in like little tight, like technical sections. You feel like you can really move the bike a bit better.
Yeah.
And if you need to last minute, you can kind of clip out anywhere. But he got me to move my cleats back, like further back on the shoes, which I told him I'd tried before and didn't like, but I ended up just doing it again. And it's just way better, like more for enduro too, because you do such long runs. So if your cleats are back, you're not standing up on the balls of your feet, which is like straining your calves and stuff for a long time. And
yeah,
it just feels a lot better. Kind of changes my, not a lot, but changes the riding position a bit. And I've been doing it since I got home, and it actually feels pretty good. That's just like a little thing. And then he was just helping out with the suspension as well. It's cool to run stuff by someone who has done it all, and he's like riding the exact same bike. So I can say, what do you think this is like? And he'll like literally just try it on his bike or same thing. So yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. He's very much into the detail. Super interesting.
Yeah, he is.
Cool. So before COVID arrived and wrecked this season, what were your hopes, I guess, for both the enduro side and the downhill side of things?
For enduro, I don't really know what to expect. I haven't done an enduro race since 2017. And obviously since 2017 to 2019, I feel like the downhill series has like elevated a fair bit. So I feel like the enduro would have done the same thing. So I don't know. I was just going to train as hard as I could and see how it went.
Yeah. And what about the downhill side? You were going to get to a few World Cups.
Yeah. For downhill, I feel like if I actually haven't touched the downhill bike since Snowshoe. Oh, actually, I did Cannonball and Threadbow, but haven't ridden a downhill bike in a while. But I feel like as soon as I get back on one and I'm like kind of back on all the parts and stuff I was using like my whole career before last year, so I feel like I can go pretty well again. Like,
yeah,
that was a bit of a shitty year last year, but I still feel like I can ride fast, and I got one top 10 last year, so if I did some downhills, I'd hope to get back into the top 10 again.
Yeah, it'd be a double threat then in both disciplines.
Have to wait and see.
Good stuff. Yeah, it'd be awesome. Yeah, hopefully we'll get some racing later in the year. But yeah, we're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got four questions that we've asked everybody pretty much, so we'll hit those up quickly. First one of those: if our listeners had £150, which is about $275 Aussie, to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
I guess it's hard to cover something that would help someone at all levels. Maybe something that we don't really have as much in mountain bikes is like going and getting good coaching from like a pro at a young age. Like I watch all the moto videos and stuff, and all those top guys, even now, they still get coached on their technique and everything. And I feel like if you got some good coaching when you're young, it would just eliminate a lot of bad habits and just help with your technique for your whole, like you'd just start learning that from when you started. Whereas I've never had a coaching session or anything, kind of like learned it all myself, and I probably still do things that are not the best technique wise. So I think that would be a good place to spend your money to just know some of that stuff. If I just knew some of that stuff like 15 years ago, 10 years ago, then yeah.
Fair play. Well, the second question is, if you could wind the clock back and sit down with yourself at the age of 16, what advice would you give him? Get some coaching.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I feel like maybe yeah, I don't know. I don't really regret too much with how I went about things, but obviously I could have changed some stuff. It's just not really coming to mind. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, yeah, get some coaching. I'm just going to take the easy way out and say that because I can't think of something.
All right, fair enough. All right. Third question: if you could have a coaching session from anybody, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Back in mountain bikes?
You could do a mountain bike one and a non-mountain bike one if you want.
Probably Sam Hill for mountain bikes, because he was just always my favorite rider growing up.
Is there a particular element of his riding that you'd want to pick into and work out?
Yeah, mad drifts, bro. Hanging it out.
Yeah. Yeah, he was wild.
Yeah, if you're the drift king.
Yeah. What about non-mountain biking?
I would pick like maybe a surfer or a moto guy. Um, Mick Fenning was always like my favorite surfer.
Yeah.
So it'd be cool to have a coaching session with him. And just go with that.
All right. And then the final question, what is something that you do every day that you feel benefits you?
A good breakfast every morning. I make sure I have a mad oat bowl, like I was telling you before. Like all the
yeah, ways. God, you'll have to tell us again what was in that.
And then, so I got a few extra ingredients last year when I was traveling with Todd and Kathy.
Yeah.
So I go oats, and then I go chia seeds, berries, dates, maybe like some sort of nuts, depends what I got at home, like walnuts or like, yeah. And then some Greek yogurt, peanut butter, and a banana and almond milk. Probably forgotten something, but yeah, it always feels good to have a good breakfast.
Do you soak the oats in anything like overnight, or is it all just mixed up? It
depends what oats I got. The ones I got at home, they're pretty hectic. Like they're real soft. So you just pour milk in them and they're good in like maybe a couple minutes. So it's, mate, it's all in the technique. I put the milk in at the start, and by the time I've finished chopping up all the ingredients and whacking them in, the oats are good to go.
Nice.
But if they're like sometimes – yeah, sometimes in Europe you get like the hard ones. So you soak them overnight.
Yeah. It's a technical process, huh?
Yeah, and then probably just stretching. I stretch every night before I go to bed. I feel like that helps.
Fair play. You actually do that. A lot of people, I think, claim to stretch but don't really.
Yeah, if I don't stretch, something always blows out, like my back or my hip flexors, or I always get like little niggling things, like my Achilles tendon sometimes, like if I don't stretch. But if I stretch consistently, that stuff's way better.
Yeah. How long would you spend on stretching then before you go to bed? Is it something you spend a while on, or is it pretty cool?
Probably like 20 minutes, 20 minutes to half an hour. I normally just watch a couple surf edits or something. Probably like three surf edits, man. That's how I time it.
Excellent. I like it. Nice one.
Or moto. Might watch a moto, a supercross. That's what I've been doing lately now that the supercross is back on. Watch a main event. What's that? 20 Excellent. Minutes or something.
Yeah. Perfect. Good way to fit in some stretching. Yeah. Cool. Well, it's been super interesting chatting and finding out a bit more. If people want to follow you, where's the best place for them to look?
I pretty much just use Instagram now.
Okay. We at what's your
Jack Moya _ I think. Yeah, just
okay.
I don't even know.
Jack Moya. _ I'll put it in the show notes so people can find it. But yeah, thanks, man. Appreciate your time. Really interesting chatting. And yeah, hopefully we get some kind of season going. And it'd be cool if we get to see you at EWS and downhill at some point in the next few months. And hope it goes well for you, man.
Yeah, thanks, man. That's the plan. We'll see what happens. I don't know if we're going to be able to fly or what, but I guess we'll just wait and see.
Yeah, we'll see. If not, then 2021 is the season for it.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. Nice one. Cheers, man.
All right. Cheers, mate. Catch you later.
All right. That's it for this episode with Jack. I hope you enjoyed listening. Massive thanks to WR1 Composites for supporting this episode. Don't forget to head over to wr1composites.com and check out their great range of wheels and the depackaged bar and stem. If you're tempted, then you can make the most of being a downtime listener by using the code HANDLAID2020 at the checkout for 15% off all stock items during the month of June. That's HANDLAID2020, HANDLAID2020, all lowercase or one word. All the links are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Don't forget to check out all of our lovely new merch over at downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode and keep on spreading the word. You can do that by telling your friends or by sharing our episodes in whatever way works best for you. The more people that listen, the easier it is for me to keep this thing going. So spreading the word really does help keep this podcast on air. Okay, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, look after each other, and if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride.